think of what you were doing in 1995 and what things were happening. I mean, people on the Today Show in America were making fun of email because they didn't understand what the little at symbol was. Everybody was just getting excited about the web and browsers and you know, learning what this word Netscape meant. What I was doing was, at the time, I was in Silicon Valley, and Visa had just made a very large investment into a company called VeriSign. VeriSign was at the time, in 1995, was a 10-person division operating within RSA Data Security. And RSA Data Security is the original founding company of VeriSign, and RSA stood for the famous RSA encryption algorithm, Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman, which are the three professors from MIT. So at the time...
When was this algorithm created?
In the 80s. Okay. And it was patented in the 80s. Eventually, you know, went into the public domain.
Yeah.
But with Visa's investment into VeriSign technology, that allowed this 10-person unit, of which I became a part of, to spin out of RSA into its own company. And the reason VeriSign was significant at that time, especially for banking and financial services, is our office was across the freeway from Netscape, which was exploding at the time in the mid-90s. And coincidentally, Netscape is the originator of the SSL technology, the Secure Sockets Layer, written by Tahir El-Gamal, who worked for Netscape. And the SSL is what allows your web browser to show you the solid padlock when you're going to a secure site. So you have the HTTPS.
Yeah.
The padlock and all of that was made possible by a VeriSign digital certificate originally that was issued by VeriSign to allow the encryption. So they worked very much hand in glove with Netscape browsers to secure those browsers.
And this protocol or technologies, those algorithms and those companies, they still exist. That's what the...
Well, Netscape no longer exists, but and VeriSign's business model has changed slightly over the years. There's many, you know, they were known as a certificate authority, CA in the business. And the digital certificates that we issued were X509V3 digital certificates to allow the functionality of SSL to work in your browser. It still works in the browser today the same way with SSL, but there are many other CAs
providers and...
in the service, and it's almost become a free commodity product. You know, you'd have to do a whole nother podcast on why the web is insecure today, but it was more secure back then when VeriSign was actually doing the authentication for people who, the webmasters that were applying for these digital certificates.
Was it only, just to touch briefly on this, was it only due to the standard required for the certification, or was it also due to, you know, nowadays being a mass adopted mean, of course, many more players are using it, which raises more interest?
Well, the problem with the CA infrastructure, you know, VeriSign was, it was almost a quasi-monopoly because VeriSign was, you know, the monopoly issuer of these certificates for server side. But the problem in keeping it secure for the long term is that you need to have a certificate revocation list, a CRL, so that when a certificate expires or goes, or something's bad or something's harmed, you need to be able to query a list that shows that that certificate has been revoked. The CRL infrastructure never evolved the way it was supposed to evolve, but we're still stuck with the legacy SSL architecture for encryption, and you know, we move forward on that. There have been a lot of workarounds since then, especially more on the client side. So with client side authentication, you're very protected, I would say, on the client side, less so on the server side, because you can be spoofed by various websites.
Okay, and from Visa and VeriSign, you moved into...
Well, let me tell you about the time period is important, because in the mid-90s is when most of the work on digital cash was just getting started and getting going. There was a company called DigiCash, mm-hmm. Started by David Chaum, which was commercializing his technology around blind signatures. And DigiCash was essentially, you know, encrypted digital cash that you could spend and use anonymously on the internet.
Just to take you back to blind signatures, what do you mean by that?
A digital blinded signatures is a way to encrypt and encode your digital cash and verify that it has the correct amounts in it and that it's authenticated. But the person who's authenticating it and the recipient doesn't necessarily have to know who the sender was. So it's a blinding protocol for allowing senders to maintain anonymity.
And why was that desirable for senders to maintain anonymity?
Because of financial privacy. So, you know, originally the motives for David Chaum, as far as I believe, are to maintain privacy from the data collectors.
Okay. And what about the end customer? Because I understand financial collect, there might be an interest to not allow data collectors to, you know, invade your financial privacy. But from the point of view of the end user or the recipient of that payment, would you, you mentioned, I believe, that they would, they could potentially not know who sent the money to them.
Well, they don't need to know the identity or the traceability of the funds.
Yeah.
Because anonymous digital cash, the essence and goal of anonymous digital cash is to replicate the features of physical cash in the digital space. So you have user-defined privacy, you have irreversibility, and you have minimal traceability. That's what we get with paper cash.
Yeah.
As you go digital and not paper, you have to maintain those same three attributes. And the way that you do that is through these digital cash protocols. And blinded signatures was the way that David Chaum and DigiCash attempted to do that. Now, when you go digital with Visa and MasterCard and American Express, you're leaving a massive trail and you're leaving a massive footprint of all of your activity. So going from paper to digital is only beneficial if you can maintain the same feature set that you do in your paper cash, which is very important for Bitcoin, because Bitcoin didn't create any new privacy. We had the same privacy features with paper cash. All it allowed you to do was to maintain that same privacy in the digital world.
But is that desirable? Isn't transparency becoming one of the, you know, most prominent, just to play devil's advocate, one of the most prominent concerns? Because I understand that cash supported these features and still does to an extent, and that that is desirable also when you enter the digital realm or the virtual realm. But the difference is that cash is a bearer title, so whoever you transfer it to holds that value, and it might not be traceable. The difference is if you want to take a large volume of cash and import them outside of a country, or it's more noticeable than a digital transaction, which is completely off the radar. So nowadays, considering, you know, how globalized the economy is and how a very sophisticated and private financial tool could be used also, not just for legitimate purposes, but also for a legitimate one. How do you reconcile this need of, you know, providing financial privacy against, you know, the potential risk of funds being used to fund terrorism or to fund, you know, for money laundry purposes and so on and so forth?
Well, I mean, I recognize that there's the current trend towards financial transparency, but you have to also recognize that financial privacy is one of the cornerstones of economic freedom. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have economic freedom, then you don't have political freedom. So you start going down a very slippery slope if you lose your financial privacy. And you just have to go to examples in China or in Iran or places where, you know, dissidents are held down. People are jailed for their political views, which they are targeted because of their transactions. A closer example would be, you know, WikiLeaks. When WikiLeaks was actually shut down from taking donations, they were blocked. They were censored from taking donations. I'm sure that if people who donated to them would have been on some target list because they made a politically incorrect donation. So there's many examples that you can think of for why you need financial privacy, and it's not because you're the bad guy.
Yeah, and but do you think so? The benefit of that outweighs the risk.
Well, I think the benefit of it obviously is what I mentioned about it's a necessary human right for economic freedom, and economic freedom is what you need to have for political freedom. Just because there are some people in the world who are using Bitcoin and other digital currencies for bad things doesn't mean that money does bad things. People do bad things. Money doesn't do bad things. You know, terrorists eat pizza and use the road as well. So let's get real. So then DigiCash went on to eventually fail. And one of the reasons that it failed was because it had a centralized mint. It was a digital currency protocol, but to avoid the double spending problem, you had to send your DigiCash token into a centralized mint. They would send you another token, and that's how you prove that it wasn't double spent. This lends itself to a single point of failure and a point of confiscation, which is very difficult to build a system that's equivalent to paper cash, because then you always have a point of confiscation where regulators can you know either manipulate the digital cash mint for their own purposes, or authorities can use it to close down any politically incorrect digital cash mints. This is what led to the closure of eGold eventually, which is not a digital cash protocol, but the authorities cracked down on eGold, run by CEO Doug Jackson, because they didn't like the types of transactions that eGold was conducting, and they didn't like the level of privacy that it afforded. And at the time that eGold was shut down, and the gold reserves confiscated, the transactional volume of eGold was approaching the transactional volume of PayPal at the time in the early 2000s. And I believe that that's why the U.S. authorities decided to move on eGold at that time, because they saw it growing in popularity. So the CEO, Doug Jackson, arranged a plea deal, and he eventually had to wear an ankle bracelet for a year or two. And that was the end of eGold. So the reason I'm telling you that is because the eGold experiment and the DigiCash experiment is what led Satoshi and other people at that time to try to figure out a way that they could solve the double spend problem without having a centralized mint, which is ultimately a point of failure for any digital currency scheme. And now we know that the evolution of Bitcoin with the Nakamoto consensus, probabilistic security, and the decentralized, distributed permissionless blockchain, this is how we solve the double spend problem. And it's also a massive breakthrough in computer science
technology,
with solving the Byzantine generals problem. That is itself very similar to Napster, LimeWire, and the evolution of BitTorrent. I mean, technology evolves to solve a problem and to fill a need. And the Napster ushered in BitTorrent, because Napster was centralized, and BitTorrent was a way to do file sharing in a very distributed way, where you're unable really to prevent it or stop it. You have to turn off the whole internet. And we still have file sharing around the world today. People are sharing files all around the world. You can think of Bitcoin as file sharing for money. It's the same technology that secures the Bitcoin blockchain and your transactions is similar to the BitTorrent file sharing network.
Do you think Satoshi took some inspiration from that?
I do, absolutely.
You do,
absolutely.
You do believe that?
Yeah. So in 2000, I relocated to Ireland and ran a company called Hushmail. Hushmail is an encrypted messaging service which gives you end-to-end encryption for email. And our goal at that time, we aspired to be the largest email provider in the email security space. And we had visions of being like Hotmail, and we would get acquired, and we'd be this big, we'd be this big encrypted email company inside of Google or Microsoft, because we had the encrypted version of Hotmail. But we made great progress, during the time, and we had the largest percentage of encrypted email on the internet. So we had about 80 to 90% market share of encrypted email. I recruited Phil Zimmerman, the creator of PGP, Pretty Good Privacy, to be our chief cryptographer. We merged the Hushmail protocol to be OpenPGP compliant, so we supported OpenPGP as a protocol. The problem in the world, though, is that the world today is happy sending naked email. And I think for the most part, they're still happy sending naked email, which is really like sending a postcard through the mail. I mean, would you put down your most serious private thoughts on a postcard or legal correspondence to a client or medical correspondence from a doctor to a patient? I don't think you would, but this is what's happening on the internet today. So the market never really evolved for paying for email privacy. And now unfortunately, it's still seen as the smaller pot that you can go after. After Hushmail, I had started writing a digital currency blog from my experience at Visa.
When was that? What year?
That was around 2007, 2008, okay. Pre-Bitcoin. So it was a pre-Bitcoin digital currency blog mm-hmm. about the efforts of the digital cash movement prior to Bitcoin. And then in 2010, I received an email from Satoshi's email account asking, this was early 2010, I think it's posted at the Bitcoin Foundation website if people want to see the actual email, because Satoshi was corresponding with Mike Hearn and Gavin Andreessen at the time as well. So the email basically said to me, I want you to check out this system called Bitcoin. I think because of your blog, you would be one of the good people to promote and market a system like Bitcoin.
Have you heard of Bitcoin at the time?
I had only heard about it vaguely, but this caused me to take a much deeper look. So I had only heard about it in the news, but I never investigated it.
Did you know who Satoshi was?
I knew that he was the creator of Bitcoin, but that was about it. I mean, it was this small little thing in early 2010 where, I was still working on digital cash protocols for gold. I thought that was the way. So this really directed my attention more towards studying about the digital cash protocols that Bitcoin was advancing and being on the mailing list at that early time in the Bitcoin talk groups was an excellent learning experience being there at the time. So I didn't, however, do one of the things that Satoshi asked me to do, which was he needed help in mining. And I only was mining for a very short time when I should have...
Level of regret.
I should have devoted my whole house to mining at that time. But I did not follow that advice from Satoshi. And then going to 2012, I had already been writing several articles a month for Forbes magazine. And this was the time when you could only have one article a day on Bitcoin. You know, now there's like 300 articles a day on Bitcoin. You can't keep up with it.
Yeah.
But originally, it was only one article a day in Bitcoin. And there were only a few people writing about it. So, I was one of the writers for Forbes. In economics and cryptography and was one of the early writers at that time for Bitcoin.
And then you became involved in CoinDesk.
Well, CoinDesk was after Forbes, yeah. And after the Bitcoin Foundation as well. So because of the Forbes writing and everything that I had done in the space with Visa and prior to that and VeriSign and Hushmail, I was invited to be one of the founding members of the Bitcoin Foundation in 2012. And we achieved quite a lot at the Bitcoin Foundation. We promoted the protocol. We responded to press inquiries because at the time the press had nobody to go to.
Yeah.
We never took the role of being the CEO or headquarters of Bitcoin. We just wanted the press and governments to have a place to go to get information, because if they didn't have that, they would have just made up their own information.
Yeah, so it's almost a point of information. Yeah,
it was an educational foundation. We also took on the task at the foundation of compensating the core developers, some of the core developers, because they weren't compensated; they were volunteers, and we wanted to provide them compensation so that we could also be able to. Understand if they were being compensated by anyone else that we might want to be aware of. The Bitcoin Foundation also was very instrumental in holding the two conferences very early on in Bitcoin's growth. We held a conference in San Jose in 2013, and we also held the still to date largest attended Bitcoin conference ever, was in 2014 in Amsterdam. And that was a massive conference, the biggest that anyone had ever seen in Bitcoin up until that time. After that conference in Amsterdam, all of the conference names started changing to blockchain conference, and people would only go to blockchain conferences, not Bitcoin conferences. And do you know why that changed?
No. Okay. When was that?
About 2014, 2015.
Silk Road.
Well, the reason it changed is because people found out that they could not put Bitcoin conference on their expense report and get reimbursed. But if they put blockchain conference, then they could get reimbursed.
Why couldn't they get reimbursed?
Because Bitcoin had all of this shady publicity. But banks were fine sending their employees to blockchain conferences. So all of a sudden, you had this mushrooming growth of blockchain
trademarks
and not so many. And then Bitcoin conferences were kind of like, it became these underground conferences, if you underworld conferences, if you named it Bitcoin.
And moving on, I know that we wanted to discuss together in the crypto arm race. Correct. Can we expand on that? Do you think we can?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, that's a key theme for the future and for the future of Bitcoin going forward. I believe there's a crypto arms race happening right now in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. But let's just focus for the main part on Bitcoin and maybe some other privacy coins, mm-hmm. which address this topic. But the crypto arms race basically refers to the tension between the users of Bitcoin who want to maintain their financial privacy, similar to the way they would retain it with paper cash, and the blockchain surveillance companies, such as Chainalysis or Elliptic, the companies that are able to do blockchain forensics and get an interesting look at particular transaction histories, where the coins are coming or going. And they do this to track crime. They do it, you know, for a number of investigative reasons that, you know, real world police are also doing. I don't think that those companies don't have a right to exist. I mean, of course they have a right to exist. They evolved in a free market. They're a free market response to a problem that the mainstream financial world wants to address, which is, you know, the history of coins.
Yeah.
But on the other side of it, you have the people who are the users of coins that don't want to be surveilled, and they have their own legitimate reasons. So the reason it's an arms race, and the reason we need to look at it as an arms race, is because we've entered this period of endless escalation, where the people who are conducting blockchain forensics, like Chainalysis, their systems and their detection, their observation is getting very good. It's getting quite good. And law enforcement is starting to rely on it without even addressing the plausible deniability issue. I think, you know, defense attorneys have a lot to work with in the area of plausible deniability. But because of the success of the blockchain forensics companies, you start to have the evolution of privacy wallets and privacy coins like Monero. But let's for today focus on the privacy wallets. Cypherpunk Holdings has invested in Samurai Wallet, and they've invested in Wasabi Wallet. Those two privacy wallet companies today hold the lion's share of the business for the CoinJoin protocol. And the CoinJoin protocol is the leading de facto standard for a protocol to allow for coin mixing. So basically, the CoinJoin protocol mixes your coins so that you are unable to determine the ultimate source of those coins. And the response to the blockchain surveillance people mm-hmm. is to start using privacy wallets and the techniques that are involved. Because even with using the CoinJoin protocol, though, there are still some things that blockchain forensics can use and analyze to narrow in on that portion of the transaction. I mean, it doesn't, nothing is 100% absolute. So they're able to get maybe addresses of where the mixing occurred. They're able to link together things from maybe Tor exit nodes that you've used that they're able to link to somewhere else. The reality is that when you only have a small population of mixers and mixed coins, it's much easier to target in and analyze those, just like it would be on encrypted email. When you only have 2% of email that's encrypted, all you have to do is focus on that 2%. Yeah. Well, it's the same thing with the coin mixing. So CoinJoin is only one thing that would be in the arsenal available to be able to protect your financial privacy. Things are evolving where you can have multiple hops. So you can conduct 4 or 5 hops of your coins before you send them on to a third party, such as an exchange. And this is a natural response to the exchanges starting to look 4 hops back and 4 hops forward for your Bitcoin. Imagine a situation where you're going to an exchange and they're looking 4 hops back from where your coins were to see if they should accept your deposit. And then they're looking 4 hops forward on where you're using your coins to make sure that you're not going to a gambling place to use your coins if you're in a jurisdiction that doesn't allow online gambling.
Yeah.
So without naming any names, this has evolved to a situation where, well, then you'll just do 5 hops. You'll do 5 hops of your Bitcoin before you send it to an exchange that is checking only 4 hops back. Yeah,
both sides are becoming increasingly sophisticated.
And you can see quickly how this becomes an arms race because the exchange will go, well, now we're going to go 5 hops back.
No, this makes complete
sense.
And
the Bitcoin privacy wallets will say, well, now we're going to go 6 hops back and do Ricochet 6 times. Because Ricochet is one of the names for one of the wallets on adding hops and multiple hops to your coins.
But do you think that the response to this then does not lie in technology? Because from what I understand, of course, both sides are becoming increasingly sophisticated. And as you mentioned, if you have a small portion of service provided that allow you to address this issue, as for the email, if you have a very small population using encrypting email, then it's much easier to develop technology which address this encryption and which lift this privacy. But do you think it's a cultural, then an educational perhaps, problem to tackle?
I think ultimately it is a technology problem, because we live in a multi-jurisdictional world. I mean, if there was only one jurisdiction that you had to deal with, you could solve it. You could at least put legal restraints on it for that jurisdiction. You could have a situation where you're solving it that way. But in a multi-jurisdictional world, you're not going to be able to do that, because everybody in a global environment will be able to go to another jurisdiction, or they'll be even able to go jurisdictionless.
Yeah.
And as the forensics gets better, the privacy technology will get better. And I don't see the end in this cycle, but I know that it's not a regulatory end. It's a technological end. And for the hope of mankind, I hope that the financial privacy side is the side that prevails.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we want to live in a future in any jurisdiction where the surveillance companies have been the ones who prevailed. I mean, would you want to live in that kind of society?
No, I definitely wouldn't. But like, my question referred more to the percentages of people which care about their privacy against that doesn't really mind. And therefore,
you're pointing to the big challenge of encryption and privacy in financial transactions. And this has gone on and on and on, because in email, people maybe don't care as much either. So it gets back to the naked email question. People don't care that much about their financial privacy.
Do you think people are caring more and more?
I think that it's an educational issue on whether they should. I think they're starting to care more and more, because they're seeing the side effects and the negative effects of surveillance. But this is also pointing to the fact of why we need to have the privacy by default.
Yeah.
It has to be privacy by default. Without the user knowing that they're actually proactively doing something, just like the paper cash that you use is private by default. It's not asking the user to do anything to initiate their privacy and exercise their privacy rights. It's occurring without them even knowing it. And then you enter the realm of, you know, 95%+ of the transactions are done with CoinJoin or some other protocol or other privacy measure, where you have 95% or more in privacy. And that, you're right, that is the answer. I mean, short of very successful education, we have to go privacy by default.
So what's the end game for Bitcoin? What do you think it's, you know, in light of all of what we talked about?
So that is a fabulous question. So I believe that the end game for Bitcoin is really about the unit of account. And the unit of account meaning that, you know, the three primary functions of money are store of value, medium of exchange, unit of account. When we can start to get to the point of expressing things in the grocery stores and the stores and how we bill clients for consulting in Bitcoin, then you will know that Bitcoin has actually been successful and made it.
I agree.
Other things, right now we're expressing Bitcoin in the dollar, in the euro. You know, you have to do mental gymnastics to convert things in the store to Bitcoin prices. But a lot of this, you know, you can see parallels with switching from Spanish peseta to the euro. When everything switched to the euro, which isn't that much older than Bitcoin, by the way, and Bitcoin will outlive the euro. But when you change it in people's mind, the unit of account is the final phase of conversion to money. And that will ultimately be how you know that Bitcoin is successful. A major touchstone along the way for achieving that is Bitcoin just needs its own currency code. If it had its own currency code, and people and banks and regulators thought of it as a currency that they could use as another foreign currency in their data systems, in their foreign exchange systems, they would simply be updating their currency table of ISO codes that are used to represent, you know, the over 160 different currencies that we have. So do you know the current designated currency code for Bitcoin?
Well, I thought mistakenly that it BTC. Which is the wrong.
Well, BTC is used colloquially. It's used a lot by exchanges. But officially, it's known as XBT. And some exchanges adopt it as XBT, not all of them. But you can also pull it up on your app on Bloomberg or XE currency apps, and you can see the quote in XBT. It'll be quoted as XBT.
Who recognizes that? How does it work? How do you get a code?
Well, this is a very interesting journey on that, is that the Bitcoin Foundation early on in 2012 went to Zurich, Switzerland, which is the grand keeper of all the ISO codes for currency. It's a non-political institution, part of six payment services, but they have their own building in Zurich. And this is where you get JPY, GBP, EUR for Euro, and then USD. All of these codes are known as ISO, International Standards Organization, 4217 codes. So ISO 4217, that's what Visa uses, it's what MasterCard uses, it's what the airlines use, it's what everybody's using for international currency codes. Well, we went and petitioned and actually went through the process of completing an application to apply for XBT to be the currency code for Bitcoin officially at ISO.
So because we wanted it to be a currency. Part of the code is thanks to you.
Part of having this denomination. Well, it's still pending. So we don't get the credit for it yet. But I'll tell you the reason why it's still pending. X is the appropriate prefix because gold is XAU. Silver is XAG, which is a chemical symbol for silver. I believe there's one for platinum and palladium as well. So you have four with X prefixes. The X prefix is reserved by ISO for non-political units. So they actually have a category for non-political units. So we put XBT as the unit for Bitcoin within ISO. It confuses them because Bitcoin has 8 decimal spaces and no other ISO currency codes have 8 decimal spaces. So they didn't know how to deal with that. Accounting systems don't know how to deal with that. There are some currencies that have 3 decimal points, which I actually didn't know, but there are some that go out to 3 decimal spaces. We applied and paid the application fee and went through the process, made our case to the ISO body in writing, and also went there in person. The reply that came back from them was a nice nicely worded but very terse letter that said, thank you for your application for Bitcoin SXBT, but we are sending you this application back because you need to have it be submitted from the appropriate central bank issuing authority. And at that point, we just said, well, they're not getting this because the whole point of Bitcoin is that there is no central bank issuing authority. And we just wanted it to be recognized as XBT in the ISO tables.
Is that a requirement officially to secure an ISO?
It's officially to how to apply for one. Yes.
Okay.
And they were unable to waive that requirement for us, even though we were successful in getting SWIFT. And the managing director of SWIFT at the time, Gottfried, was very helpful in mentioning XBT for us and on our behalf, which is why it's de facto the currency code for Bitcoin. But it's only on a de facto basis for general usage. It's not. It has not yet to this date received the ISO approval.
So, but if it was to receive the approval, basically that would mean that the system is accepting decentralization.
If you ever see it approved within ISO, that is a massive buy signal for you to go online and just start buying Bitcoin as fast as you can, because it means that it will be in all of the data tables that get pushed out to all the companies that are involved in currency. They'll start having XBT officially in their data table. That's a massive buy signal.
Let me ask you one thing, because you said, of course, you know, when people start, when Bitcoin gains a soul in the mind of people, because like it has its own identity and people think in terms of Bitcoin, this camera costs X amount of Bitcoin, this microphone costs X amount of Bitcoin. But can you have something like that right now where the price fluctuates so steeply?
Well, no, excellent point. You know, Bitcoin currency and Bitcoin usage as money, even though Bitcoin is just a protocol, it's simply just a protocol like mm-hmm. TCP/IP. Its usage as money and a token, an exchange token, is very, very new. I mean, we're only talking 11 years. Bitcoin just had its 11th birthday.
Yeah.
That's like a little baby trying to walk. So you can't expect all of the volatility and lack of liquidity to be ironed out, within that short time period.
Yeah.
It's the most successful digital currency ever on the planet, with market caps that have approached over $250 billion before, and over time, as liquidity increases, that volatility will start to diminish. But right now, the volatility is a natural part of the growing process, and that's exactly why it hasn't achieved unit of account status. It's achieved store of value status,
mm-hmm.
and it's crossing over the threshold to what I believe is medium of exchange status, but it hasn't fully crossed over into unit of account. And one of the reasons, a large reason, is because of the volatility. You can't have that kind of volatility if you're using it as a unit of account successfully. I expect it to be, 6 to 10 years out for something like that.
Do you think also in terms of moments? So, for example, from an outsider view, if you want, or from a view which is not as informed as yours, I assume that the price would stabilize once the cap is reached, and when the level of adoption it would be very, very high, because that's the only way, because the coin is not really dependent on how states perform. I mean, it is indirectly affected by that, because if a state performs badly, the trend probably is that people start investing more in cryptocurrencies, like what happened in South America, for example.
It will become a lot more relatively stable as it moves to unit of account status. I mean, I'm saying 6 years because it really depends on the user friendliness for the wallets to get more adoption. So we're still a long way from that, and we're a long way from the price stability. What we have now is upward volatility,
mm-hmm.
and I say upward volatility because there's a natural inherent tendency through adoption and the Bitcoin halvings every 4 years to have natural upward volatility in accordance with the stock to flow model. But going back to your point about whether it's used in payments and as a store of value, to get to that level, we'd be looking at a price that's much higher than we are now, because just to equal the supply, above ground supply of gold, would imply, which is $7.5 trillion US dollars. to equal this above ground supply of gold, we'd be at a $450,000 per Bitcoin price. And it's encroaching on gold as a store value asset. Mm-hmm. But the Bitcoin potential doesn't stop there. The Bitcoin potential goes beyond that into private offshore banking. Think of the assets that are currently in private offshore banking. Once Bitcoin starts getting into that market, you're talking about first challenging gold for a store value market asset, and then starting to challenge making inroads into the sector of the market that is banking, offshore banking. I mean, you're if Bitcoin is successful there, you're adding massive liquidity, but you're also looking at a much, much higher Bitcoin price.
Plus, to me, like I was about to ask you actually about the price, not due to this reason, which makes perfect sense, but just because if this was to become, as I hope, as the both of us hope, you know, a widespread instrument for payment and for exchange, there necessarily need to be a higher value per unit because there is a cap.
Absolutely.
At 21 million. And to prevent, you know, people with large financial capabilities to manipulate the price of the market, the only way you can do that really is by increasing the price per unit.
Well, yeah, to be able to send a $50 million Bitcoin transaction instead of a $50 million wire somewhere, you need to be able to have market liquidity to support a $50 million
exactly.
transaction. And right now, going into the market with $50 million is going to be very disruptive to the price. So the liquidity is not there for commerce on that scale. So the price is following, in my opinion, is following hand in hand the adoption of Bitcoin in commercial usage, in commerce. And in turn, that price is what I believe drives the hash rate.
And last question, if it's fine for you.
Yes, of course.
This is a curiosity. You know, a few months ago, Google hit the news with this with this successful processor, quantum computing processor. Do you think that will bear an impact on Bitcoin and on its usability? You know, because I always thought that the decentralized system and the fact that you are competing to mine the next block, provided that it's based on current technology, then it's hard to becoming having a monopoly over who is going to win that race every 10 minutes to write the new block. But the moment you start introducing quantum computers, for example, do you think that could potentially affect the decentralized nature of Bitcoin? Do you think?
No, I don't.
You don't believe so?
And the quantum computing is an interesting question. If current data, current analysis suggests that we have about 20 to 40 more years for the effective usage of SHA-2, which is the underlying consensus algorithm that Bitcoin is operating under. Okay. SHA-2, it's a hashing algorithm, but it's also being used by the banking system and by ATMs. So if you have problems with quantum computing, you're going to be also affecting the ATM networks. You're going to be affecting the bank networks, and it's not something that happens overnight. You'll see the stampeding feet approaching. We have much bigger problems than Bitcoin if all of the ATMs around the world are compromised.
Yeah.
But with respect to Bitcoin specifically, the quantum computing issue is brought up quite a bit. The elegance of the Bitcoin protocol, however, allows you to interchange and update the consensus algorithm. So it's not that much of a challenge for Bitcoin to go through a consensus algorithm update if there's anything potentially that we see down the horizon for SHA-2 being compromised.
And Just to follow
that's why it's not a problem for Bitcoin.
Just to follow up on this question, if the consensus algorithm can be tweaked, why has it not been tweaked to insert, in your opinion, of course, to insert a cap on the processing power? Because that would allow for better distribution, because that would allow anyone potentially to be a miner with their mobile phone, for example. Why hasn't there been a cap on the processing power of the machine with which you mine?
Well, first of all, I mean, it wasn't written that way. It was written without a cap on the hashing, which allows for the permissionless competition. And I think it would be detrimental overall to have a cap on the hashing for a number of reasons. The first thing that comes to mind is that we would have already blown by whatever the first cap would have been thought of, because no one expected, ASICs and the type of mining that we have right now in the Bitcoin world. But more importantly, you need to have it uncapped to maintain Bitcoin resiliency. The reason that Bitcoin is a successful protocol over DigiCash with the centralized mint, and the reason that BitTorrent is a success over Napster, is because of the resiliency. It cannot be shut down. It cannot be targeted. And it's unfortunate that we have to use as much energy as it takes to power the country of Denmark to run the Bitcoin blockchain. But that's not... it's not Bitcoin's fault. It's not citizens' fault. It's not miners' fault. It's the fault of the adversaries. We need to have that high hash rate to maintain the resiliency from the bad state actors and from anyone who might try to neutralize the network.
I see. John, thank you so much for this interview. It's been
absolutely
incredible.
A pleasure. I love being on the rock.
Thanks you so much.
Cheers.
Thanks again. Bye-bye. Bye, everyone.